WCCO Outdoors on News Talk 830. Welcome to the broadcast on this Sunday, May 10th, 2026. We are wrapping up fishing and opener weekend here in Minnesota. The walleye and pike inland waters opener began yesterday, May 9th. I think folks had a pretty decent weekend, maybe a hair cooler than we expected a few days ago going into the weekend. Probably a pretty typical opener, I would think, in terms of the status of the fish out there. In their crabby post-spawn mood, perhaps a little bit, showing warmer temperatures later this week that should bring water temperatures up across central Minnesota, maybe getting up into Lake Country. And I suspect we're going to have just excellent walleye fishing as we get deeper into the month, which is pretty typical. That's pretty average here for Minnesota. Memorial Day weekend is usually the best, not the best, but it's usually where I think walleye fishing really starts to improve, and then you get into June, and that is the prime walleye month. So congratulations to everybody who did get out. I hope you had a good time with family and friends and caught some fish along the way, too. We still have turkey hunting happening, of course, until the end of the month, and it's morel mushroom season out there. I haven't seen any pop up in my backyard, or I haven't had anybody try to sell me any just yet. So probably a hair cool for prime mushroom eruptions. But I think that's going to improve very much here in the next few days also. So spring is here. It's gorgeous. I just love this time of year when the leaves are like this fluorescent green and the water is blue in all of our lakes. Pretty tough to beat Minnesota right now. Two good guests coming at you as the show unfolds. Ed Hahn from the National Eagle Center is going to be with us. They've got a big event down there in Wabasha, a first day of issue for some bald eagle stamps that the U.S. Postal Service is unveiling, and they have decided to do it at the Eagle Center. So we'll talk to Ed about that. Then Brad Galsman, Executive Director of the Minnesota Wildlife Federation, will be with us. His organization, among others, is watching some items involving dedicated funding in the state legislature quite closely, and he's going to flesh that out with listeners here in about a half an hour. As I like to do, a couple quick news items I thought I would share before we get to our first break. First off, no one else reports some of these items, which is why you got to put up with me talking about it frequently. One, I've talked a lot about crossbows during the general archery season. This first passed in 2023. But the legislature placed a two-year sunset on it. Well, then last year, I think they just kicked the can down the road for another year. They said, we're going to just extend the sunset one more year into 2026, and then kind of left it for this year's legislature to make a decision. Are we going to keep crossbows during the general archery season, or are we going to, alter what we've done the past 3 years? Well, it looks like we finally, once and for all, have a decision on this, what turned out to be a very non-controversial issue. Now, I personally have never been a big fan of crossbows during the general archery season. The idea behind the general archery season was that it was challenging to kill a deer with a bow, and that's why archers got a really long season. And that's not the same equation. That's not the same paradigm with crossbows. They're much easier to learn to use quickly and become effective with. And, I mean, the old-timers call them cross guns, not crossbows. Well, in the past few weeks, the legislature has voted on this item. It passed, I believe, 67-0 in the state Senate, the decision to keep crossbows as part of the archery season. And then it more recently passed the House 133-0. So clearly Rob is the voice yelling into the 80-mile-an-hour wind on this one by himself. Not completely by myself. The Minnesota Bowhunters, Inc., they wrote a commentary in Outdoor News outlining their opposition to it. Also, some of the archery purists, of which I guess I am apparently one, never really liked it much. But as I said, clearly we're the anomaly. And the vast majority of public and certainly state legislators are just fine with it. And so I think that is the last word. I don't think this is going to come up again. I think crossbows as part of the archery season are here to stay. One quick final sour grapes editorial comment, which would be, unanimous, really? 200 legislators at the state capitol all agree on this? I mean, you want to talk about bipartisan? I guess here you go. There wasn't a single legislator in St. Paul who stopped and said, we created this archery season to be difficult. That's why we give these guys like 100 days to hunt every year. Is this going to have any impact on, our white-tailed deer doe harvest? Is it going to impact doe tags perhaps in some deer permit areas? And could that affect firearms deer hunters somewhere in the state. They're still the vast majority of hunters. Those are still the guys that manage our deer more than anything else. Should we look out for them a little bit on this? You know, there wasn't a single legislator who said that, and I don't think that's that outlandish to suggest that one of them might have said, let's dig a little deeper into this before we just approve it. I think that kind of illustrates maybe how detached the vast majority of our legislature is from the nuts and bolts of fish and wildlife management here in Minnesota. But again, as I alluded, maybe that's just Rob's sour grapes. It's time to move on. And I'm going to try not to talk about this ever again. It certainly appears that crossbows during the general archery season are here to stay. You're going to be able to use them again this fall. One other quick item before we grab a break. It looks like all of the counties have chimed in on whether or not they are going to allow rifles during the firearms deer season starting this fall. Our state legislature in 2025 decided to eliminate the shotgun zone last year, effective for the 2026 season, and they gave all these counties, they told all the counties, it's up to you to decide if you're going to allow rifles. They gave them until May 5th this past week to make the decision. Now, I think the DNR wants to approve it. They want to check all this against their previous deer permit area borders, shotgun and rifle border, that sort of thing. But I don't think it's going to change much, and we reported in Outdoor News this past week that 13 counties decided that they want to stick with shotgun only. That's out of, 87 counties in the state? So roughly 85% of the counties are going to allow rifles this fall. 13 of them will not. And as it stands right now, those 13 counties are Houston, Dodge, Faribault, Brown, Wantanon, Cottonwood, Jackson, Nobles, Rock. Those are all in the southern portion of the state. And then there's four that are more kind of in the central portion of Minnesota, Candy-Yohai, Pope, Wilkin, and Clay counties. So as it stands right now, if you live in one of those counties, you're going to be restricted to a shotgun for deer hunting this fall again. Doesn't mean it couldn't change in 2027 or going forward. The rest of the state, you'll be able to use a rifle. This isn't final, final, final. I think the DNR wants to put its stamp on it, but I suspect it's going to be pretty close to what I just shared. And if there's any updates, obviously, between now and the deer hunting season, I will let listeners know. Again, I think it's odd that the legislature allowed this so that the counties could decide. I hunt right on the Winona-Houston County border. I'm in Winona County. I'll be able to use a rifle. The guy across the fence line in Houston County, he's going to be restricted to a shotgun. I guess it works out in my personal favor, but I just think that's an odd dynamic. Anyway, I have gone on long enough. Let's grab a break. We will return and talk with Ed Hahn from the National Eagle Center about a big event they've got coming up on Thursday, May 14th. When we return, this is WCCO Outdoors. WCCO Outdoors on News Talk 830. Welcome back to the broadcast on this Sunday, May 10th. I'm Rob Jerisline. We are going to talk mostly about the U.S. Postal Service event cooking at the National Eagle Center down in Wabasha this Thursday, May 14th. We'll check in with someone from the Eagle Center in just a moment. Before we do that, I got a press release from the Minnesota DNR this past week saying that they had certified a lake sturgeon as the new catch-and-release state record for that species. Apparently, a gentleman named Travis Keating caught the fish on April 18th on the Rainy River in Lake of the Woods County. We just had a story in Outdoor News this past week by Mark Sandquist writing about his trip last weekend on the Rainy River. He caught and released hundreds of pounds of sturgeon up there. It's an incredible fishery. But this Keating fellow was up there with some friends apparently on April 18th, caught this fish. It measured 80 inches long with a 38-inch girth. The DNR has a chart of lake sturgeon length, girth, weight estimates that apparently would put the fish around 165 pounds. Truly incredible. And if you listen to this broadcast, you know we had Brian Brosdahl on a couple weeks ago talking about how the lake sturgeon on that border water just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I think Brian even said we're on the verge of catching an 80-incher. Well, there you go. Now, interestingly, the DNR did not issue a photo with the press release publicizing this catch. I don't exactly know why. Presumably you can search online and perhaps find a photo of this big new catch and release record. The DNR implemented catch and release records, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago. You can learn all about it. The agency has a state record fish webpage. Just go to mndnr.gov and search state record fish, and you can learn all about the process of registering fish there. And now I want to talk about a big event going on down in Wabasha this coming week, May 14th, Thursday, May 14th. It's at the National Eagle Center. And here to talk about what's cooking down there is Ed Hahn. He is the Director of Marketing and Communications for the Wabasha-based National Eagle Center. Ed, thanks for joining me for a segment.
Yeah, my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about the National Eagle Center. I don't believe I've ever had a guest on from the Eagle Center. It's a great asset here in the state of Minnesota. It's a beautiful facility. Tell us about the National Eagle Center and why it ended up in Wabasha.
So we are now in our 27th year of operation there in Wabasha, and we're kind of a unique venue. We're a little bit of a nature center, but we're also a museum, and a part of our collection is living bald eagles and other raptors. So currently we are home to 6 permanently injured but rescued raptors. We have 4 bald eagles, we have 1 red-tailed hawk, and then we just recently added and debuted an American kestrel to our team. So we're really thrilled about that. You know, what people come to us for is really kind of a variety of things. We obviously have the live eagle ambassadors that they can meet each and every day when they go there, but we really do broader nature and environmental and conservation education, but it's all through the lens of raptors, specifically bald eagles for the most part. And yeah, we're just kind of connecting people to the natural world. Certainly there are cultural and historical elements to it as well, and that is reflected in our programs and our exhibits. And so, yeah, it's a really unique experience. There are other venues in the state, obviously, that have bald eagles on display that you can go and see. But the way we handle that and do that at the National Eagle Center, as far as we are aware, is wholly unique.
The website is nationaleaglecenter.org. So very easy if folks want to check out and learn more about the facility that I'm talking about with Ed. Not only do you have eagles on the inside of the facility, eagle ambassadors, as you said, but the Mississippi River, that Wabasha area, and even downstream, Winona, Trumbull, that area, one of the best places in the country to view wild bald eagles, right? That's in part why it was built where it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Outside of Alaska, which by, leaps and bounds, far and away the highest population and highest concentration of bald eagles in North America, or certainly in any of the 50 states, this is the best place to view them. So we're really fortunate here in the upper Mississippi River Valley to have the eagle population that we do, to have the year-round viewing that we do. It's really no accident that we are located in Wabasha. It grows out of the fact that when bald eagles were still a pretty rare sight to see, Wabasha was one of the places to go to see them, and it still is today.
I remember in the early 90s, I was living in Winona and I was a subscriber. I believe it was Outside Magazine did a story on, top 10 places to watch and see eagles around the country. And they did not include the upper Mississippi River. And I don't think I wrote a letter, but I was furious about it because I think it arrived in my mailbox like in March, right when a ton of eagles are moving through that area. And I believe it was like within a day or two, I walked the Trumbull National Wildlife Refuge as ice was going out. And of course, there's a lot of dead fish and carrion as ice is going on. And I think I counted like 120 eagles that day just on the ice. It's a great place to view eagles. It's hard not to see an eagle if you're cruising around that part of the state, especially in late winter.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, now that the bald eagle population really has, I mean, not only are they no longer endangered, they came off the endangered species list in 2007 as well, but their population has really boomed. I've heard figures, I don't have an exact count, I don't think anyone knows the exact number, but I've heard reports that they believe in North America, the bald eagle population is as large as it's ever been since the arrival of Europeans, which,
that's awesome.
Which says that population has fully recovered from the brink of extinction. And to your point about just the wonderful venue we have here on the upper Mississippi River, we offer year-round experiences at the center that really make the most of that. We have winter field trips that we take people out, and we go looking for both bald eagles and golden eagles, which are here in the winter season.
Ed, real quick, you mentioned the golden eagles that are kind of in that bluff country border area of Minnesota and Wisconsin. My parents used to participate in your golden eagle watch, but they winter somewhere else now, so they haven't been doing that. Are there as many golden eagles wintering in that area as there were before, or has it plateaued? Any idea off the top of your head?
Yeah, that's a great question. The research is really ongoing. What's interesting about golden eagles and our understanding of them in North America specifically is that it's a relatively recent understanding that we even have golden eagles in the eastern part of the United States at all. If you look back at kind of birding books and birding guides, even from the late 90s, and you look at the range map for golden eagles in North America, you really would not see any presence of them indicated east of the Mississippi River. And so for the last 25 years, we have been running a program called the Golden Eagle Survey. And it's now not only, it's not the only one anymore that's actually up and running. There are other surveys in the eastern part of the United States. We go out, we have trained volunteers. We all go out on the same Saturday in January every year. And we're basically just counting and all the gold eagles that we observe. That survey is specifically for golden eagles. Our surveyors basically report everything they see. And so we are tracking other populations as well. But, you know, to your question, it's hard to know if the population is expanding, if it's staying steady, because you do get fluctuation year to year on those counts. Sometimes it just has to do with the weather. You know, some years we go out and it's just, you know, where it's overcast, it's socked in with fog, and so the visibility is bad. But even on regular years, you do have some variation. Now, we do know through some previous catch and release with satellite transmitters, we've been able to track those golden eagles. And so we know exactly where this specific population of eagles is nesting. And so in the wintertime, they are literally migrating south, in some cases, 2,000 miles or more into parts of the eastern United States. We certainly have them here in the Bluff Country, in the Coulee region. You won't find them really in the Mississippi River Valley proper. That's how they differ from bald eagles, which are very much water birds. Mm-hmm. But golden eagles are upland predators. So you're going to find them back in the Bluff Country. But they have also been spotted in places like the Ozarks. There's some ongoing research going on in the Appalachians. We've learned a couple years ago about a program that even down in Alabama where they are doing some golden eagle research and surveys. It's a very specific population of golden eagles. They are nesting during this time of the year just south of the Arctic Circle up in Nunavut, which is up in extreme northern Canada. And so they are only here in this part of the country in the wintertime. But yeah, fascinating. And it's just really fascinating that they do travel that far in the wintertime to come and make use of different parts of the eastern United States. Fascinating phenomenon.
You're listening to WCCO Outdoors. We're chatting with Ed Hahn. Ed is the Marketing and Communications Director for the Wabasha, Minnesota-based National Eagle Center. You got a big event coming up this Thursday, May 14th. The U.S. Postal Service is doing its first day of issue. I remember that term from when I was a kid and collected stamps of a series of five bald eagle stamps designed by David Allen Sibley. He's very well known among birders, responsible for all the images and a very popular bird watching book. So this is an exciting event and it's open to the public.
That is correct. Yep. So a week from this Thursday on the 14th, we will be hosting this first day of issue ceremony at the National Eagle Center that will be taking place outside the center in the Riverfront Amphitheater there in Wabasha. It's free to attend, open to the public. It will be featuring several invited speakers will be part of that program. We anticipate it'll be about 45 minutes to an hour in length. That will be at 11 a.m., but our doors at the center open at 10 a.m., and the Postal Service will also be starting sales of those stamps on site at 10 a.m. as well on the 14th. So, yeah, we invite people to come to Wabasha, check it out. We've had a lot of people reach out to us since the announcement went out that are stamp collectors, also bird enthusiasts, who are eagerly anticipating getting their hands on this series of stamps. So, yeah, it should be a great event. Hopefully the weather cooperates for us, but it's really exciting. And of course, 2 years ago in December of 2024, the bald eagle was officially declared the national bird of the United States. And so part of the 250th anniversary of the United States here in 2026, they are issuing this commemorative forever stamp featuring the bald eagle. So yeah, we're honored that the Postal Service decided to host that event in Wabasha at the National Eagle Center, and we're really looking forward to sharing that experience.
And Mr. Sibley, David Allen Sibley, will be on hand, is my understanding. Attendees are encouraged to register at www.usps, that's U.S. Postal Service, usps.com/baldeaglestamps. You can find more information and you can register. Should be quite a party. One more time, this Thursday, May 14th, down in Wabasha, Minnesota at the National Eagle Center. Ed, thanks a lot for joining me. Good luck with the event. I suspect you're going to have a surly crowd of, what, philatelists? Is that what they call themselves? Stamp collectors?
Yeah, no, we're excited to do it. It should be a great event, and we're just really excited to be able to share that experience with all the people who come out. So should be a great time.
NationalEagleCenter.org, one more time if you want more information. Ed, thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Ed Hahn from the National Eagle Center down in Wabasha, Minnesota. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages. WCCO Outdoors on News Talk 830. Welcome back to the broadcast on this Sunday, May 10th. I am Rob Jerisline. We're going to devote most of this segment to talking about some shenanigans cooking at the state capitol involving some important conservation funding. Brad Gausman from the Minnesota Wildlife Federation is going to join us. Before we do that, I want to briefly remember the passing of an important North American conservationist, Western Hemisphere conservationist. Ted Turner passed away this past Wednesday, I believe, May 6th. To most people, he was just kind of the founder of CNN, a big media mogul. But he was a hardcore pioneering conservationist, managed like roughly 2 million acres of private land in the U.S. and Argentina, really focused on, you know, native species, restoring biodiversity, protecting endangered species, and apparently managed the world's largest private bison herd, over 50,000 head. I'm a big proponent of bison and buffalo, and I'd like to see the United States do more to try to restore their numbers. Of course, the Trump administration is doing just the opposite on some of our national grasslands, but I don't have time to get into that right now. But also, you know, an avid sportsman, you know, he was not a, you know, an animal protectionist by any means. And I know at least a couple guys who hunted elk, I believe, on a couple of his ranches, that they would not include me. I could never afford to hunt elk on his private ranches. And the people I know who hunted on his properties had excellent experiences. I understand he established the Turner Endangered Species Fund back in the 90s, again, focusing on non-game and game species like cutthroat trout. And he did, you know, he worked with like adjacent landowners to do, you know, massive ecosystem restoration out in Montana and in other places. I love that kind of vision. I love a guy that took his money, his billions, to do really good things for the environment. I don't know a lot about Ted Turner's personal life. I know he was married to Jane Fonda at one point. I don't know his politics, but I definitely appreciate the things he accomplished on the landscape. Obviously, a lot of the coverage early this week focusing on him being a media mogul, but I suspect we're going to hear a lot more about his conservation efforts. Rest in peace. Ted Turner died at the age of 87. Now let's bring it back to Minnesota. A gentleman who hasn't been with us in a while. I think it's been a couple years since Brad Gausman has joined us. He's the executive director of the Minnesota Wildlife Federation. There's a lot going on at the state capitol. As the session winds down, I want to talk to Brad about. But before we do that, Brad, this is the first time we've talked since your organization had a bit of a name change.
We did. Thanks for having me. So as you said, I'm executive director of the Minnesota Wildlife Federation, and our organization recently changed our name. From about 1936 until last January, we were Minnesota Conservation Federation, but our board of directors saw an opportunity to kind of rebrand a bit, re-engage with folks across Minnesota, and create a little bit of a closer connection with our independent affiliation with National Wildlife Federation and all of our surrounding states that also have wildlife federations as well.
The website is mnwildlife.org, and you've got a fairly new, younger, robust board of directors. Tell us about that, too.
Yeah, we've worked the last few years to kind of onboard conservationists kind of with unique skills and interests to aid in helping us accomplish our mission. So brought on a number of folks that are engaged in our in-person programming and have kind of skill sets around specific issues we're interested in, such as foraging and advocating for native rough fish.
Well, let's talk about the breaking news, the important news that's cooking at the state legislature. The session ends, I think, is it May 17th or 18th?
It's the 17th.
Just over a week away, so coming up fast. And as of early this past week, I wrote part of my column about this, Brad. to the environment committees and the full legislature had not passed the LaSard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council Outdoor Heritage Fund bill, which is important. There's like $191 million at stake there. This hasn't been a problem for a long time. It seems like it usually passes through without too much issue. What seems to be cooking here in 2026? Your organization issued an action alert on the matter last weekend.
Yeah, you know, the appropriations of the legislature for legacy bills is really important to make sure that we get legacy dollars on the ground making the most impact possible. The LaSard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council approves projects. You mentioned $191 million. That was over 53 individual projects that were approved as a package unanimously by that council and then sent to the legislature, who is charged with appropriating those funds. And, you know, we have a robust system in Minnesota of kind of legacy councils that make those recommendations, do a lot of the vetting work to make sure those projects are appropriate and in line with the spending of the funds. And then we kind of go through the legislative process to make sure that those dollars are appropriated. Typically, the legislature has kind of approved projects with kind of the approval of those legacy councils. This legislative session, there was a bit more of a holdup with some discussions around one specific project up in the Roseau area, and then conversations about kind of structure and governance of the LaSard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council as well. So that kind of held it up a bit, and we're waiting to see how it all plays out. It sounds like there is a Senate bill that passed through two committees with those Outdoor Heritage Fund appropriations. So we'll see where the House goes. But it's really critical that these funds get passed. The Outdoor Heritage Funds are appropriated annually. And so it's really a positive thing when the legislature kind of takes action to put those conservation dollars on the ground.
Yeah, as I wrote in my column, this has generally gone pretty smoothly over the years. These are state tax dollars that are dedicated through that sales tax dedication that we passed in 2008. So this isn't general fund. These are dollars that are earmarked specifically for these projects. And it's important that we get these dollars in the ground, right? The sooner they get in the ground, the better. In the early days of this, Brad, I don't know if you recall, this might have been before your time, when we would interview gubernatorial candidates out at game fair, we would get them on the record. Will you demand that the legislature respect the will of the council? And, you know, what the council says, basically the legislature would support. And, you know, governors all were on board with that. I remember, I think it was in 2013, we had some urban Democrats try to add a bunch of spending for, I think there were some AIS dollars, as well as some metro dollars that were added. The council had not approved them. And Governor Dayton line item vetoed those out of those. He abided by his pledge that he made at game fair that he wanted the will of the council to be respected. And it seemed like ever since then, that kind of set a precedence, you know, that we, okay, the legislature's not going to mess with this until this year came along. We got a couple amendments. You mentioned the one involving Roseau River. The other two, one involves maybe a more substantial process for hiring an executive director of the council. There was a little bit of scuttlebutt about how thorough that process happened this last time around. And then also, should members have term limits? And as I said in my column, I'm not necessarily offended by either of those two amendments, but I don't want them to bog down the process so that we don't get this passed this year. Perhaps, you know, what Republicans should do is offer those as separate bills during the 2027 session, you know, that come up through the Environment Committee process.
Yeah, I would agree with you. You know, there's always an opportunity to look at how to strengthen processes and the activities of councils, you know, especially within kind of the legacy environment. There is a time and place to have those, and the legislature is kind of discussing, you know, is that appropriate in committee? Should it come from the council itself? Should the legislature be charged with kind of recommending back to the committee those changes? To kind of the idea of the recommendations of the council and the governor and the legislature, you know, there are always conversations about how to spend money, and legacy is a pool of money that must be appropriated by the legislature. So there are conversations about, you know, which projects to fund at different times. But we have a really strong system of vetting projects through different legacy councils that I think is really appropriate for the legislature to kind of pass as suggested. I also serve on the Clean Water Council, representing statewide hunting organizations. We also spend a lot of time looking at these projects, vetting them, talking to the folks that are going to be carrying out the work before making those recommendations to the legislature. So recommendations are taken very seriously by these councils and are done so with kind of the stated statutory purpose of those funds.
Brad, cutting to the chase, per your action alert last weekend, what can listeners do? What should they be doing here? The idea is we want to get these bills passed. How can listeners out there make that happen?
Getting in touch with your elected representatives is always a positive thing. You know, having constituents reach out to their elected leaders, you know, let your representatives know that you value the Sard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council's recommendations, and you want to see the Minnesota legislature pass an outdoor heritage funding bill that puts conservation dollars on the ground across the state, and that they really respect the recommendations of the Outdoor Heritage Council.
Yeah, these are our dedicated funds. They need to be spent appropriately. Get it done. That's a simple message that I think every citizen should tell their state rep or their state senator. This is WCCO Outdoors. We're chatting with Brad Galsman, the executive director of the Minnesota Wildlife Federation. Hey, before we go, Brad, the governor signed some proclamation on Friday, May 8th, that has to do with native roughfish? Tell us about that briefly.
Yeah, that's right. We're really excited as an organization to be involved, and we're kind of recognizing some of the amazing native rough fish in Minnesota that were reclassified recently as such, and are really excited that on Friday, May 8th, right before the Minnesota fishing opener, the governor will proclaim May 8th to be Native Rough Fish Day in Minnesota. So maybe a great opportunity kind of right before the kind of the typical game fish opener to go out, maybe target some of those unique species and really appreciate all of the amazing fish that swim in, creeks, rivers, streams, and lakes across Minnesota.
Yeah, these species have kind of a new designation now as native rough fish, and there's also some new limits that the DNR is proposing for them also. So new respect for our rough fish, not to be confused with common carp, which are our worst aquatic invasive species, as well as the invasive carp making their way up, the invasive Asian carp making their way up the Mississippi River. But we're talking like bigmouth buffalo, quillback sucker, all of our red horse species, some of those others. I'm with you. I'm glad these fish are getting newfound respect.
Yeah, me too. And I'll say, I think my favorite is the drum or the sheep's head. Once I learned that they eat zebra mussels, let's get more healthy populations of drum in our state to maybe help battle that AIS problem.
Used to catch a lot of them on the river when I was a kid. Well, anyway, Brad, thanks a lot for joining me. I'd encourage folks to visit your website, mnwildlife.org. Follow you on some of the social media platforms also and keep track of some of those action alerts like the one you guys issued last week, urging membership as well as citizens statewide to contact their state senator or rep and tell them to get the Outdoor Heritage Fund dollars in the pipeline before the session wraps up.
That's right. Any advocacy from the public on this issue would be greatly appreciated.
Brad, have a good fishing opener weekend, and we'll talk to you in the future.
Thank you so much.
That was Brad Galsman, Executive Director of the Minnesota Wildlife Federation, mnwildlife.org. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages. WCCO Outdoors on News Talk 830. Welcome back to the broadcast on this Sunday, May 10th. I am Rob Jerisland. We are wrapping up opener weekend 2026. Walleye opener kicked off yesterday, and by all accounts, it was a pretty good one. I saw a quote in Outdoor News this past week from a bait shop owner who suggested that opener weekend maybe not quite as big a deal as it used to be. You know, maybe the word is out, more people hold off, and they know the fishing's a little bit better, at least for walleyes, around Memorial Day weekend, and that's become a bigger deal. I suspect people are just being smarter with their time and probably trying to maximize those hours on the water when they've got the best opportunity to actually catch fish. Couple quick items before we go. The Minnesota DNR last week held a press conference where it unveiled its first phase of its new electronic licensing system. This thing has been brewing for years, and I'm glad to see the agency getting closer to releasing it. It sounds like that might happen as early as this summer, maybe even in June. It looks good. I mean, it looks like they've got an app, so you're going to be able to just download this app and go in and buy your license. you know, off your smartphone, wherever you've got cell phone or Wi-Fi coverage. And that's great. It's taken a while to get to this point, and I hope they pull it off. I hope they work the bugs out, and that we're all using this new app this summer. I think it's going to make everybody's life easier. I think it might also actually help with license sales, right? If you make it easier to buy a license, I think more people will do it. Maybe they're up at a cabin visiting a friend or something, and someone says, hey, let's go fishing. They can spontaneously, easily buy a license. I think they'll do it. I think it's going to help revenue for the state of Minnesota, too, for the DNR. Finally, before we go, how about this crazy story out in New Jersey? A rabid beaver attacked a family, and there was a lot of chatter about this past week. Some folks saying, you know, the people were pestering the beaver. Deeper into the week, I was reading more about, no, it sounds like this beaver had been a problem, maybe even for some other people. The crazy video was it a kid or a teenager? Literally, after the beaver chases him up onto the shoreline and bites him, by the young man, I'm sure had to get rabies protocol. The kid picked the beaver up and threw it back in the water. Man, I've been around a long time. I've never seen video like that before where someone literally picks up a beaver and heaves it back into a water body. And you know, I saw a lot of chatter about, you know, well, leave the beavers alone. They're peaceful. And, you know, they are mostly. And 99 times out of 100, it's people who are responsible for a situation like this. They let their dogs get too close or whatever. They infringe on their habitat. But I tell you what, anyone who's really spent time outdoors knows that beavers are highly territorial. I've had them, you know, come close to my canoe in the Boundary Waters and slap their tail. Backwaters of the Mississippi River where I grew up down Winona way. Beavers are big and they can be mildly aggressive. So if you're out of doors and you get close to a beaver, give it its space. They're bigger and stronger and toothier, go figure, than you might expect. And well, with that public service announcement, I'm going to sign off. Everybody, have yourself a great week out of doors. I'm Rob Drusine, signing off for WCCO Outdoors.